Accession number 30018, really 11.
John Farley, Reel 11.
So, this Handy Page 115 was built just to look at Concorde approach handling. As such, it had a maximum speed of 250 knots. It had a fixed undercarriage, and it wasn't... In fact, originally, when RE specified it, they wanted to do it as cheaply as possible. They thought to make it a glider and tow it to height and just make it very slender. But once people considered how short a length of time you would get in each sortie to evaluate things on one approach, it soon became economic to actually put an engine in it to make it more complicated and more expensive. But you would be able to get 40 minutes or something a sortie out of it instead of just 30 or 40 seconds of effective work and then got to tow it back up again. The other aeroplane that Aeroflight had was a thing called the BAC-221, which was, in fact, it came during my time at Bedford. This was a modification of one of the two Fairey Delta 2s that were built in the 1950s to investigate high-speed research. Now, the Fairey Delta 2 was an ordinary-looking delta. In other words, it wasn't extremely swept back. The leading edges were about 45 degrees, so it had got a reasonable amount of span for its length. And the Vulcan, of course, was a similar aeroplane, not a slender delta, an ordinary delta. And so the Fairey Delta 2 was unrepresentative of the shape they were expecting to fly at high speed, in that it didn't have what they call an OG wing. That's a curved shape. I mean, when you look at the Concorde, the leading edge of the wing is not dead straight. It's got a very nice curve in it. It's called an ogival shape. And so they built a new set of wings for a Fairey Delta 2 and put those on, which were of the Concorde shape. And this was going to be used for high-speed research of the aeroplane, its handling and performance. And so we had these two single-seat aeroplanes. Later, when it came to deciding that we needed to do some research on a thing called a takeoff director, which was an instrument specially designed to help Concorde pilots cope with an engine failure on takeoff. The thing about these slender deltas, which makes them quite different from other aeroplanes, or one of the things, is the very high drag they have when they fly at low speeds. Now, I don't know if you are familiar with this term, angle of attack, but if you watch a high-speed jet fighter at an air show flashing past at goodness knows how many hundred knots, it seems to be dead flat. Its nose is pointing in the direction it's travelling. Now, that angle between the direction where the nose is pointing and the direction the airplane's travelling is probably only half a degree. You know, it's very small. When the same aeroplane comes along for what the commentator calls a low-speed pass, it'll possibly have its undercarriage down and so on, which has nothing to do with it, but the next thing you'll notice is that the nose is pointing right up in the sky. The aircraft is not climbing, it's flying level, and it has now got a big angle of attack, and that angle could easily be 15, 18 degrees. Now, The lift that any wing produces, regardless of its planform shape, is a product of the angle of attack and the speed squared that it's flying at. I mean, there are other factors in the equation, like the density of the air and the span of the area of the wing and so on. But that's a minor detail. The two important things which the pilot is going to change throughout the flight are the speed and the angle of attack. So when you're going to fly very slowly, you haven't got much speed, and therefore, because you need the product of speed and angle of attack to be equal to the weight of the aeroplane, you have to have this big angle of attack at the lower speeds. Fine, and so what sort of thing? Well, if you have a slender delta, this effect is even more magnified, and you need to have a very high angle of attack because the wing is so slender. Now, This means that as you start to slow down below normal flying speed, you actually get to a point where the drag of a slender delta increases as you go slower. Now, that may seem a difficult concept to get hold of, but think of the lift from the wing. The lift is the result of low pressure on top of the wing, and it acts perpendicular to the top surface of the wing. Now, when you're flying along at high speed, that's fine. Your wing is flat, the lift is pointing straight up, and everything's fine. As you start slowing down, and shall we say you put 20 degrees angle of attack on the wing, now your lift that you're generating is actually inclined backwards at 20 degrees. You're still generating a lot of lift, but it's inclined backwards. And of course, that rearwards component of your lift is effectively drag. It has to be opposed by the engines. So as you go slower and slower in that class of aircraft, excuse me, you find yourself opening the throttle more and more and more. Now, slender deltas don't stall as easily as ordinary wings. In other words, they can be taken to very large angles of attack before the airflow changes in a way that makes it sort of rubbish and the thing doesn't want to fly. Well, what happens when you get to sort of 20, 25 degree angle of attack is that you've got this huge drag. And you will probably find in a slender delta, as you slow down, that there will come a point where you get to full throttle. And you can't go any slower, can you? And what's more, you can't accelerate either, because your drag from the rearwards inclined lift is exactly equaling full throttle. So what can you do? You can't accelerate, you can't climb. Well, the only thing you can do is to lower the nose, reduce the angle of attack, reduce the drag of the wing, and dive off a bit of height. You're going to lose some height, maybe only a few hundred feet, but you're going to lose some height. Get rid of some height and swap that back for speed. Well, that's fine, and in things like the 221 and the Handley Page 115, our two little single seat flying scale type slender deltas. So what sort of thing? You get full throttle. But now, if it's a multi-engined aeroplane, this speed where full throttle is required just to equal the drag is called the zero rate of climb speed. Common sense, isn't it? It means you can't climb unless you put the speed up. Well, your zero rate of climb speed, if you lose one engine on a multi-engined aeroplane, it's going to go shooting up because you've now only got three engines. So your three-engine zero rate of climb speed is going to be perhaps 20 or 40 knots faster, depending on the type of aeroplane, than your all-engines running zero. And in your two-engine zero rate of climb speed might easily be 150 knots faster. So if a slender delta pilot loses an engine on takeoff, he or she has got to think of getting that nose down pretty quickly to some very new different angle. Now, you don't want to put it down too far because you're going to lose an unnecessary amount of height, and you don't want to put it down too little because you won't be able to accelerate. So the Boffins at Bedford, I mean, this was all what people were talking about in the 60s. The Boffins at Bedford said we'd better have a takeoff director, which was an instrument that looked just like the ones airline pilots were used to using on the approach, called an instrument landing system, where you have a couple of cross pointers, a vertical one and a horizontal one. And if you track the vertical one, that kept you on the center line of the instrument landing system at Heathrow or anywhere. And if you track the horizontal one, then that had you coming down the glide path at the right angle. So airline pilots were very used to using that sort of display to track a particular requirement. And the Boffins at Bedford said, well, let's use the same sort of display. The vertical bar will tell you the runway heading and keep you going straight after takeoff. The horizontal bar will be raised or lowered by the automatic system in the aeroplane to indicate what you should do with the nose of the aircraft up and down. And the clever thing, of course, was to develop the law that drove that horizontal bar. If you make it too twitchy, it's hard to fly. If you don't make it twitchy enough, you know, it's not going to be accurate enough, and these sort of things. So the Boffins wanted to develop this thing called the takeoff director. And when I say this thing, I mean the box that was going to drive this instrument, the clever computer-based thing. I mean, computers were analog in those days. You know, they weren't what we call computers today. And so you needed a fair bit of kit and a lot of space and so on, and it wasn't that easy to make changes to one because you had to change hardware and so on. So, all right, we're going to develop this kit. Now, what should we do? Shall we try the different laws and equipments in the 115 or the 221? Because, of course, we can always throttle the engine back to 3/4 power or 1/2 power. Well, yeah, okay, but the problem is that these little single-seaters are very light. They only weigh a few tons, whereas your big aeroplane, you know, could weigh hundreds of tons. And as we know, the inertia effects of something that is big and heavy are very small, are very large compared to something which is small and tiny. I mean, you can try and push start a mini and you might well be successful. You couldn't push start an articulated lorry, at least not by yourself, you know, because of the inertia of the thing. So the Boffin said, well, when we lose an engine on a big heavy aeroplane, that aircraft is going to respond quite differently because of its high inertia and in pitch as well as longitudinally. So they said, well, all right, well, let's use a Vulcan. That was the closest thing they could find to a Concorde weight and shape. I mean, it was a long way away from the Concorde shape, but at least it offered the weight. And so we developed the Concorde takeoff director in a Vulcan. So we had those, we got the Vulcan while I was at Bedford, and we had a great deal of interesting flying developing this takeoff director, because, I don't know, I did about 115 hours of takeoffs and landings only in a Vulcan, you know, which is a lot of fun, and without the boring business of flying halfway to Moscow and turning around and coming back. So it was, I'm rambling on a bit about the Concorde program, but it was an interesting program that had many facets to it, and I shall always have a sort of slightly sentimental attachment to the Handley Page 115, because it was the first pure research aeroplane that I was asked to fly. It also, of course, looked like a flying paper dart thing, you know. And, I mean, you walk out to this, you think, oh, I'm a test pilot, I am, because look at this thing, you know. Well, rubbish. I mean, you look at the shape of this thing, and it seems so extraordinary. You think, my word, we need super people to fly this. Rubbish. It was the easiest aeroplane to fly that I have ever flown. And everybody that we checked out in it climbed out afterwards and said, why don't they make them all like that? So what the Boffins had feared, which was this lateral control would be too sensitive and too difficult for a variety of reasons, and pilots wouldn't be able to cope, they would have a control, did not turn out to be so in practice. Now, the aerodynamics were exactly like the Boffins predicted, and common sense would suggest this lack of damping. What made it different was that from what they were expecting, was that the pilots could sense this very rapid rate of roll when you touch the aileron. I mean, the old-fashioned expression, seat of the pants, you know, you're actually sitting in it, and you are triggered at once by this roll acceleration, not the roll bank attitude change, but the acceleration. And you just back off. So it became lovely, you know. I suppose it was probably the 115 was the most successful United Kingdom research program ever in terms of the data it produced for how little it cost and how many years it went on and how many pilots flew it. And I mean, it really did justify the Concorde shape in a very impressive way.
Can I ask you about the Vulcan? Because obviously you said you had quite a lot of hours on the Vulcan. Well, how did you find that as an aircraft?
Well, I was a small aeroplane man. I mean, before I went to the Empire Test Pilot School, I'd only flown single jet training aeroplanes, a single piston draining aeroplane, and meteors, and one Hunter tour. So I was very much a small aeroplane man, a fighter man, and I had not flown any large aeroplane that required a crew, let alone had a lot of weight. So I was fascinated. I mean, I was given this great big monster with four other people sitting in it, you know, and just got to drive it around the circuit, and I thought it was wonderful fun. But that's the sort of boy racer thing, isn't it? It had got this huge amount of thrust, the Vulcan, and we weren't flying it at maximum all-up weight because we had no need to. We weren't going to cruise for 7 hours on the way with some heavy bomb load and so on. We were just going to do 6 or 7 takeoffs. We had to keep landing in order to do another takeoff, but I mean, it was takeoffs which were the basis of the test. And when we did these takeoffs, we were stopping engines at different stages of the takeoff in order to establish how the takeoff director system responded and whether it did the job. And the Vulcan was so overpowered that you could go out on one engine. You would chop one engine shortly after the aircraft started rolling, another one as you rotated, and the third one just after you unstuck, and you'd be getting a different signal each time to set the attitude and so on. And it was amazing. I mean, you were down to about 200 feet a minute rate of climb, which is a negligible angle of climb. But that was all right at Bedford, because at the end of the runway 27, the ground fell away into a valley. And so you were going away from the ground much faster than you were actually climbing up. And so it made it perfectly reasonable from a noise and safety point of view. And of course, you were only throttling the engines back. You didn't turn them off. So if anything had happened to that one engine, you only had to open the other three up and so on. But no, that was just, I only mentioned that from the point of view of how much power a Vulcan had. And so it was a very, very invigorating aeroplane to fly. An awful lot of wing, and the only aeroplane I ever flew where I never felt short of wing.
What was the next stage of your World War I program, did you?
Yes, well, after the Hunley Page 115, I think the next one I flew was the Fairey Delta 2. But it was later on that year when Jack called me in and said that he wanted me to go down to Dunsfold and collect an aeroplane called the P-1127 XP-831, the first prototype P-1127, which was at Hawker's airfield at Dunsfold, and had been the original jump jet that Hawkers had started flying in 1960, 4 years earlier, or nearly 4 years earlier. And they had made 6 of these things, each one incorporating improvements once they found the deficiencies and problems and issues with the first one. There were 6 prototypes. They had all 6 flying after 4 years, and they reckon that the first one now was so unrepresentative of the detail of what they were now thinking of that they'd stop flying it. And in particular, the changes that they were making to these aeroplanes as they built each one were aerodynamic rather than the jump jet bit. The engine was the same, the nozzles were the same, the reaction control system was the same. But they were fiddling with intakes, they were fiddling with the wing shape, tailplane position and so on, to improve the way the aeroplane flew at high speed. While the Boffins at Bedford were only interested in the jump jet bit, the flying it on the engine and flying it at low speed and through the things called transitions. The manoeuvre where you go from the hover to on your wings is called an accelerating transition. And when you do the reverse and you slow down, it's called a decelerating transition. So the Boffins were very interested in this VSTOL, the vertical and short takeoff and landing mode of flight. We already had the short SC-1, 4 vertically mounted lift engines and 1 horizontal engine to push it along like an ordinary aeroplane. And this was obviously very different from Hawkers. Hawkers had one big engine and swivelling nozzles on the exhaust of that engine. The Short SC1 had four small vertically mounted engines. The Short SC1 was clearly much more complicated. The Hawker P1127, though, had got this huge single engine, which was necessary to pick the whole weight of the airplane up, which was too big by normal fast jet fighter design standards in the cruise. You don't want to have a jet engine in a fighter that is operating at sort of half throttle. You want it to be operating fairly close to full throttle most of the time if you want to get a lot of efficiency out of it. These turbine engines like to be 90% of their RPM or more. And so there was this thought that, well, you know, this big engine a lot of the time in the cruise is going to be throttle way back and it won't be as efficient, and et cetera, et cetera. Well, I mean, this is what people, again, were thinking in general terms in the early 60s. So the Boffins wanted this P1127 at Bedford to compare it directly with the SC1. And I was given this, what I thought was the best job in the United Kingdom at that time, you know, to go down to Bedford, go down to Dunsfold and pick this thing up and bring it back to Bedford and be the project pilot on it, doing whatever the Boffins wanted to compare it to the SC1. And that's what happened.
Obviously, with an aircraft that takes off vertically, it's different in its mode of takeoff from other aircraft. Is that a problem, or is that just, again, another simple thing that you learn, or is it something that you had to grasp? Or I don't know how different they are.
Well, they are, of course, as you say, totally different in what is going on. You're either going straight up, relatively slowly, but going straight up, or you're charging along the ground, and obviously that's quite different. There are two things when dealing with a hovering device that make it very different from an ordinary device, an ordinary wing-borne aeroplane. One is the visual cues. How do you decide what your hovering aeroplane is doing? In other words, you're sitting in a hovering device. It could be a helicopter, could be a fixed wing, doesn't matter. You're sitting in it, looking out the window. Imagine what that looks like. The ground's a little bit below you. You're not moving. And then suddenly you notice something on the ground that is now in front of your nose. It is moving, you know, away from the aeroplane. Is this because your aircraft has gone backwards a bit? Do you follow? Is it because you've come down a bit? Because you can't see down through the floor, so you've got this blank area where you can't see. And if you go lower, then things appear from underneath the nose. Or is it because you've lowered your nose? That would also. So there's three possible things that could cause that one point of reference to move. Well, you have got to understand or make a decision about which of those things has happened in order to move a control to correct it happening. So you've got to learn these visual cues. And you might say, well, how on earth can you sort that out? The answer is you look outside. If you look outside, you can see whether the nose has dropped because the thing's sitting there at a different angle. If you look out the side, you can detect rearwards motion over the ground. So in a hovering vehicle, you tend to keep your head a bit on a swivel so that, you know, you're continually taking in, yeah, that's right, exactly. And it's a bit like somebody learning to drive a motor car. When they're struggling, they just peer over the bonnet and they've got clenched fists. You, the driving instructor, once they've learned how to make this car go faster and slower, left and right, you want them to keep their head on a swivel so that they can see the traffic all around them, so they can see the traffic lights, they can see the idiots coming out of the side road and so on. So this business of looking all around you is often important in this life, and it is essential in a hovering vehicle. Well, you can be taken off in a helicopter and taught these visual cues. You do not have to be taught how to fly a helicopter in order to learn those visual cues. And so I was actually in the January of the year I went to Bedford, because they were expecting this me to do this work. I was sent back down to Farnborough for a couple of weeks to do a helicopter checkup, and I was actually taught to fly helicopters by one of the instructors at ETPS, because we had some helicopters at Bedford, not just because they wanted me to learn the visual cues of hovering for the jump jets, but because we needed to fly helicopters on other jobs at Bedford. And so I had had my helicopter checkout. Therefore, I had got this visual cue thing sorted. Now all you're left with, of course, is the difference between the vertical takeoff and the horizontal one. Now, the SC-1, the four lift engines, were controlled by a single control in terms of increasing their thrust. And it was what was called a collective. That's a lever which your left hand is on, and you pull it up, and it's at an angle. Pushed right down, it would be almost flat on the floor. Lifted up, it would come up to 45 degrees or perhaps even 70 degrees, you know. Helicopters have them. That is how you control the height in a helicopter. With your left hand, raising and lowering this thing called the collective lever. So, if you think about it, it's quite instinctive. If you want the airplane to go up, whatever it is, the helicopter or the jet airplane, in the case of the short SC-1, you lift the lever. If you want it to go down, you push the lever down. Your right hand is controlling an ordinary stick. And, yes, if you push this forward, the nose goes down. If you pull it back, the nose goes up. If you push it to the left, the airplane rolls left and so on. That's just like any other airplane. And in the helicopter, that is called the cyclic control, because it works cyclically to control the angle of attack of the blades to make the rotor disc tilt. So, now the short SC-1 had therefore the same control philosophy from a pilot's point of view as the helicopter, and so there was nothing sort of new to be learned. Yes, there were differences in response, and yes, you've got to worry about the hot gas, and yes, you had to keep starting and stopping these engines and so on, but, and yes, you were flying a 5-engine bomber by yourself, so there was a lot to do, but the actual polling of it, the actual flying of it, the actual making it go up, go down, go left, go right, was very simple and very basic and very pleasant and not at all difficult. But it was an extremely complex machine that you had to look after. It's not the same thing as handling, you know. And a complex machine like that, of course, had also got lots of different failure cases, which you had to try and get your head around in case one of them cropped up. Now think about the Hawker P-1127, a thing which looked like an ordinary jet fighter, had an ordinary throttle, control on the left-hand side of the cockpit. You push it forward, the engine goes faster. Pull it back, the engine goes slower. Every jet engine has one. You had got that. But alongside it, between you and the throttle, was another lever. And this controlled the angle of the nozzles. Pull that lever back, and the nozzles swung down. Push that lever forward, and the nozzles pointed aft. Now, the engineers, when they first started thinking about this concept, said, well, wait a minute, you pilots like to have controls move in the same direction as whatever it is you're controlling. So when the nozzles are aft, and that is pointing aft like an ordinary jet airplane, really that lever ought to be aft, and when the nozzles are forward, as they would be when you're hovering, lever ought to be forward. And we said, no. Pilots push things forward to go faster and pull things back to go slower. And so you had to think in your head of the P-1127 control system as the throttle was a make the engine go faster, make the engine go slower, pushing it forward, pulling it back. The lever was a make the aeroplane go faster and make the aeroplane go slower for a given position of the throttle. So that was how it was. And you just had that one extra lever in a P-1127, nothing else.